there's a lot of trailers making the rounds. I guess if, like, we're basically back to normal now as far as the movies are concerned. Like,
yeah,
we're not seeing a lot of stuff getting delayed. So there's trailers coming out. It feels like the schedule for the next half of the year is pretty solid. I don't know what to expect from Jurassic World Dominion.
Did you like the last one?
No, I was kind of bored by the last one. I felt like they were kind of coasting a little bit. But I mean, this one, how much more wild can they get? They have the dinosaurs just running around all over the world now. So,
well, you forget the biggest selling point, which is bringing back the original cast minus the kids.
If they're actually in it for a significant amount of time and they're not just like, you know, they haven't given us all of their scenes in the trailer.
It feels like they would be at least in like the climactic part of the movie at the end, at least.
You hope so. Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping for at least a couple of one-liners from both Jeff Goldblum and Sam Neill.
Oh, you know there will be. I was hoping Muldoon would come back, but I guess he's dead, huh?
Oh, no, he's raptor meat, man. He's.
It's actually crazy to think that all these franchises have been revived and they're like 30 years old. Top Gun's part of that. And the early reviews for Top Gun have been like really, really good.
Yeah, the critical consensus on that is like more positive than I've seen on anything in a while. Avatar 2 has also got its own fan base, you know?
Okay, so what did you think of the first Avatar? Have we ever talked about
this? I can't remember if we did.
I was really underwhelmed.
I mean, it was fine. Like, you know, at the time, like, it was the first, like, true 3D movie, like a 3D movie that didn't require the red and blue lenses. So all of that was, like, it was cutting edge for the time, so that added to the effect. I don't remember if I saw it more than once in theaters. I don't.
You don't have to. You shouldn't.
And that should be enough of an indication, you know, like if it wasn't good enough to make me come running back to the theater to see it again. And I certainly haven't watched it since on Blu-ray or streaming or anything like that.
Yeah, same.
You know, I can take it or leave it. I mean, I'll probably see the next one because I'm sure it'll be a big cultural moment and blah, blah, blah. And we'll have to see what Mr. King of the World has cooked up. But
it could be a huge commercial flop.
It could. Yeah, it totally could. I mean, I would be very entertained if it was, because it would be the first time in a long time that James Cameron had been overestimated, I guess.
Well, I just remember the first movie, like, the plot and the characters were the worst part of it. The biggest selling point was the technical aspects of it. And from the trailer, the new one, which is subtitled Way of the Water, the CGI actually looks pretty cool. And I kind of like all these new animals and creatures they come up with. I'm just really wary of the actual story itself, because to me, that's the biggest selling point.
Yeah. I'm curious too, like, it's opening at a different time in the movie industry. Like, when the first one opened, one of the things that really pushed it over the edge in terms of becoming the highest grossing film of all time, which it held until Endgame took that crown, was that it was one of the first Hollywood movies to open in China, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this huge new audience that just came flooding, and they wanted to see some like crazy over the top American movie that had effects that weren't possible for many other directors anywhere. You know, James Cameron was kind of leading the charge on that. And, but this time, like, the movie is opening in the wake of like 20 plus Marvel movies. And I feel like people aren't quite as wowed anymore, no matter what part of the world they're in. So
I think there's a point to that for sure. The other point I'd like to raise is that given our current political environment with all these sanctions,
yeah,
there's a chance those markets may not be open like they were 20 years ago. Or
yeah,
not 20, but like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's fair. And I mean, will Cameron be willing to like re-edit his films to keep up with the censors in the various countries? Like,
well,
not to say that he would necessarily include content that they would find objectionable, but it's a possibility.
I mean, I guess he could just write it off as like aliens being weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they're not humans, they're aliens, so it's okay. And I mean, Sam Worthington has not become like an A-list Hollywood star like many thought he would after that in Terminator Salvation. But of those, like, which excites you the most?
Of the
It's got to be Top Gun.
Oh, yeah. 100% Top Gun. Yeah. I would.
Yeah. Have you seen some of the footage with like the flights and everything?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The planes? It is amazing.
The acrobatics they're pulling off, the different angles they got. Like, in some cases, I think they were mounting like 6 cameras to the inside of the cockpit, capturing all these angles simultaneously. And like, they not only did the actors have to pull like real hard G's while they were mm-hmm. in the planes, but they were operating the cameras too and having mm-hmm. to remember lines and things like that. So they asked a lot of them, and I mean, that's typical of a Tom Cruise production, but just like some of the stuff that you see in those trailers just looks unlike anything you've seen on camera before. So
I'm yeah.
psyched for that. That's going to be the highlight of the summer movie season, I think. Unless, I mean, what else other than Jurassic Park? What's the other really big one?
There's Thor. Thor's coming out.
Yeah, I'm excited for Thor. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple. I'm sure we're missing a couple because I think Black Adam is coming out this summer too, but we have not seen a single promotional teaser or trailer for it.
No. There was a bit of footage of him in character mixed into some reel that was done for Comic-Con or DC Fandome or uh-huh. one of those events, and like there was a few seconds of him in the costume like talking and stuff, but it wasn't a trailer with a story or
but
anything.
The point is there's a lot to look forward to, and Top Gun's one of those summer blockbusters where who cares if the plot is thin, it's going to be exciting and knock your socks off anyway.
Yeah, exactly, because you know that's what Tom Cruise specializes in. And mm-hmm. and then we have the other two Mission Impossible films not too far away, so.
That's true. That's true. So it's about time. All those films got delayed by the stupid pandemic. So I'm excited to catch up on these films, I guess. Quote, yeah. unquote, catch up. But do you want to get started?
Yeah. Yeah, let's kick it off.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn, I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. My name is Jason Chen in Vancouver. With me is my co-host Robert Snow in Toronto.
Hello, hello.
Today in this episode, we're going to talk about the big blockbuster season that's upon us. But first, we're going to talk about The Northman, Robert Eggers' Viking epic revenge tale, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And if we have time, we'll get into the TV stuff. Winning Time, the HBO series about the Lakers dynasty, and Apollo 10 and a half. Subtitled A Space Age Childhood, which Robert saw. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm still kind of basking in the Viking glory of the Northmen, actually. Like, you know, I'd been riding a high after Everything Everywhere All at Once, and then mm-hmm. the Northmen was just another like great example of like, you know, independent auteur movie that mm-hmm. That really like, you know, got me excited to be back at the movies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I see from our Letterboxd scoring that we followed our usual pattern though. So you liked it a little bit less than I did.
Oh really? Okay, interesting. So before we get into it, The Northman, or is it Northman? Which one is it?
The Northman. I guess.
Or is it Northman?
Well, there's no space. So.
Okay. Well, I guess you could call it both ways. I feel like Northman is more badass. Like it's not Batman. It's Batman, not Batman.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, The Northman is a epic historical fiction film directed by Robert Eggers. Alexander Skarsgård plays Amleth, and it's loosely based on, well, actually, I think the Shakespeare story Hamlet is loosely based on this story, which is about Amleth avenging the death of his dad by the hands of his uncle and his attempt to retake the throne that was unrightfully taken from him.
I will avenge you, father. I will save you, mother. I won't kill you if you'll live.
Why would you stow away to such a hellish place?
To find what was stolen from me.
And what is that?
The kingdom.
in its entirety, the plot is quite simple. It's son exacting revenge for his dad, and it's told through this Robert Eggers lens where it's part fantasy, part gore, part sci-fi, mystical, mythological, sort of like fog of war type of style.
Yep. And like Amleth is a berserker warrior. Like he, after he's exiled from his kingdom as a child, he joins up with this crew of slavers and becomes a berserker warrior. So he's he gets kind of steeped in this religious ritual where they are convinced that they are imbued with the spirits of animals, and his spirit animal is like the bear wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And he you know, roids out and rips the throats out of his enemies out with his teeth.
Yeah,
and, you know,
it's pretty brutal.
He's hulking around, you know, he's Alexander Skarsgård spends most of his time in the movie just with his head kind of like sunken forward, his shoulders up, like he's kind of mm-hmm. slouching, but he looks like he's ready to like rip someone in half at all times.
Yeah, he's got kind of like a Neanderthal walk to him. He spends nearly half the movie half naked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Usually shirtless. And then at the end, I mean, you get this. I mean, we'll get there. But the conclusion is just like full nudity. So,
yeah. So Skarsgård is Amleth. His dad is played by Ethan Hawke, the murdered King Arvindil Warraven, who is murdered by his uncle, who is
Fjolnir.
So, you know, like when I was watching this movie, some of the names just kind of flew me by. I just kind of recognized the characters by their faces because there's not a lot of characters.
Right.
Nicole Kidman plays the queen, Queen Gudrun, who is Amleth's mother, who gets kidnapped by Fjolnir. And along his journey, Alexander Skarsgård Amleth falls in love with Olga of the Birch Forest, who is this sort of Slavic sorceress.
Yeah.
Who gets kidnapped along with him, and it's kind of like a love story slash tale of succession because she becomes a very vital part of his bloodline.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And like one thing about this is the movie is always flashing to these fantasy elements that you mentioned, like
yes,
you know, we get a meeting between Amleth and this eyeless witch played by none other than Bjork. And
I didn't even know it was Bjork until I looked afterwards.
Or he goes on this sort of vision quest to a buried Viking warship that has the skeleton of a former king in it. And he fights with the king's zombie to claim his sword, you know, this knight blade that he uses to exact his revenge. So
that was one of my favorite parts.
He's always having these like encounters, which you're not sure are they real, or are they like fantasy, or is it a dream sequence, or is it and it can kind of be explained partially by Robert Eggers himself, who said that, you know, as far as he's concerned, he's trying to make the most historically accurate Viking film ever. And part of that means depicting the characters the way they kind of interacted with the world, which was they were so religious, like religion, all of the mm-hmm. gods and monsters of their world were so integrated with their society that they could look at something normal and perceive a god or a monster in it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the viewpoint that we're getting. Like, you know, we know that there's no such thing as a blade that can't be drawn except at night or in the shadow of a volcano.
Yeah, but yeah.
Amleth is so pent up with his like lust for revenge mm-hmm. that he can't draw the blade unless it's at the exact opportune point. So it's stuff like that. You know?
There's definitely a lot of symbolism in it. Like there's a lot of allegory that they depict through visual methods.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to kind of take it literally, even though obviously it didn't happen quite like that, but I don't think it ever took away from this story.
No.
It's very compelling in the sense that revenge tales, I think, are always really fun.
Yeah.
Because you get to really root for a character, and I was really rooting hard for Alexander Skarsgård in this one. And the one thing, though, that I didn't anticipate, and I probably should have because it's Robert Eggers, was how brutal it was.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot for some people. I mean,
exactly.
We get multiple horse decapitations. We get several disembowelings. I think he makes a sculpture out of body parts from some of
multiple sculptures.
Yeah.
He writes messages with human limbs.
Yes.
And even the first battle where they sort of raid this village that they come across, and they, and the night before, they have this ritual where they basically embody the spirit of a wolf or a bear.
Yeah.
That part was incredible to me, and it's sort of already foreshadowed, because when Amleth is a kid, his father takes him to this like shaman guy played by Willem Dafoe.
Yeah.
And they sort of engage in this ritualistic, animalistic, barbaric ritual where they sort of channel their inner fighter, their inner animal, so that they would become fearsome warriors.
Yeah. And it's not, so it's not like a stretch that Amleth ends up as a berserker later in life. Like, it's clearly something that like he had been trained to do. And I was also kind of struck with, like, you know, you were saying that you root for Amleth mm-hmm. as he goes through his campaign of vengeance, because, you know, he is an underdog. You want him to like get revenge. But it's interesting mm-hmm. how the movie kind of flips that on its head later on.
For
where,
sure.
Where it's like it shows that not only was he probably wrong to do some of the things that he mm-hmm. did, but it's possible that like, even if he was a totally successful and like managed to survive all of this stuff and, you know, mm-hmm. overcome the odds, it's probable that like, you know, if he had kids with the Anya Taylor-Joy character, Olga, that mm-hmm. he would be just as terrible a father as any of the guys who came before him. Like, I could easily see his sons rising up to try to kill him, you know?
I guess. But, you know, that's interesting you say that, because Ethan Hawke, who plays his dad, gave off the impression that he was like a pretty ruthless and cold person. He was driven by, you know, empowering his people and creating this empire and protecting this empire so that they could have this sort of civilization that they could live in.
Yeah. He's also motivated by like glory and like battle lust, because he, you know, he wants to die in battle. That's the mm-hmm. thing that Vikings allegedly wanted. And, you know, if they died off the battlefield, they wouldn't get mm-hmm. to go to Valhalla. So mm-hmm. that actually pisses off Gudrun, because she just wants him to, like, be a normal husband and father.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even want, like, when he comes back from the war, he doesn't even want to
sleep with her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he that of course, you know, precipitates some of the stuff that happens later. But
so it was really interesting. And we're kind of going to spoiler territory now. But you said Amleth, that his motivations may sort of be misguided. One of the biggest plot twists was Gudrun actually being, well, I don't know if she was possessed, because Nicole Kidman kind of played it like she was possessed.
Yeah.
But she basically implied that she was part of the mastermind behind the plot to kill his dad.
Yes.
I don't know if I bought that part. I kind of felt like it was kind of thrown in there just so that it wouldn't become so much of a generic revenge tale. What was your take on that?
That's interesting. I mean, I will say that the final speech that she has
mm-hmm.
with Amleth, where like she kind of lays it all out for mm-hmm. him, the monologue, it worked for me up until the point where he kind of runs away in shock and she kind of does this like evil laugh.
Yeah.
That was the part for me that kind of undercut it a bit. But I thought it was interesting that like up until that point, we were kind of told as an audience, like, Fjolnir is bad. He doesn't, you know, he stole this kingdom out from underneath Amleth, all of these things. But yet when we saw him in Iceland, he was still like a caring father to his younger son,
mm-hmm.
you know, like he didn't seem like a maniacal despot who was like beating his men or anything like that. Like he seemed like a pretty normal guy who just had, you know, had seen this opportunity to kill Ethan Hawke's character.
Right.
So he wasn't an out and out villain. And that already kind of sets you up to expect like, oh, okay, so maybe we'll actually feel a little bit mm-hmm. bad if Amleth is successful,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So Fjolnir, that's an interesting character, because by the end, you're kind of sympathetic towards him rather than Amleth.
Yeah,
especially exactly. The final battle at the volcano, where they basically kill each other. At that point, you're not quite sure who to root for, which I think, one, showcases Robert Eggers' ability to sort of you know, guide you in a direction that you don't think you might be ready to go. Kind of like in The Lighthouse with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, where you're kind of confused, like, who is the straight guy here?
Right.
Like, who's the normal guy? And I also think that although it's good, I kind of left feeling a little unsatisfied.
What do you think would have been the more satisfying ending?
I think it would have been more satisfying to have Amleth maybe at least get to the bottom of the story. Because this kind of goes back to Gudrun, who I felt played it like she was kind of possessed.
Mm, okay.
So I would like to see Amleth at least establish a more peaceful kingdom, I guess. Rather than leaving his wife and his... I think she was pregnant with twins, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than leaving his widowed wife with twins that she has to raise by herself, who one day probably has to fight another person for the throne.
Yeah. I see what you mean. Like, it's definitely not the most satisfying ending, but I think this might get back to like Eggers's idea to make this more historically accurate. Like, I think he wanted to show Viking society as this dog-eat-dog kind of, people obsessed with generational kind of success and glory. And you know, they're not the best family units. You know, they're kind of, they're just always killing each other no matter what's going on, you know, because it's all about getting to Valhalla, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing I want to mention was, too, that the actor who plays Fjolnir, Kleiss Bang, I thought he did a much better job than Alexander Skarsgård, who I don't find is a particularly good actor. I think he looks the part.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think he kind of broods a little too much and his delivery is a little stiff. I didn't find he had a lot of chemistry with Anya Taylor-Joy, who's in it far less than I thought. And she kind of appears out of nowhere. And it's kind of implied that she knew all along that she was going to be the mother of his children, but never really reveals it.
Mm.
And kind of like tricks him into taking this boat so they could escape and raise their kids elsewhere before he realizes and then jumps off the boat and swims ashore to get his revenge on top of a volcano.
I didn't pick up on her tricking him necessarily. I think she wanted him to leave and kind of give up on his revenge plot because she thought, oh, okay, he's accomplished pretty much everything he should, you know. Then he, you know, has that revelation on the boat that he's like, oh, you know, if I do this, I won't go to Valhalla, basically. Which is,
and also he can't ensure the safety of his children.
Yeah, because he assumes that Fjolnir will send people after him. So, which is, you know, that makes sense, I suppose. I agree with you that like Skarsgård is definitely sullen and not the most charismatic. I think I can't tell if that's just the way that he is or if that's something that he intended.
Yeah,
because he's trying to convey the idea of a guy whose like whole life has been wrecked and he has no joy. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, fair enough.
hard to see what Olga sees in him beyond the kind of beefcake physique.
Well, I guess the bloodline, but that's about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so weird because there's no DNA testing back then, right? All is there is like a medallion or necklace that he wears to prove his identity, but who knows how accurate that
well,
is.
Well, there's...
Right? So.
There's the cosmic world tree Yggdrasil or whatever it's called. Yeah,
maybe you know, Anya Taylor-Joy had access to the World Wide Web and Ancestry.com before anyone else did.
Yeah.
And that was her witchcraft.
She goes into a trance. She sees the tree with all the people hanging on it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's because that seems like Alexander Skarsgård can see that thing. That's how he has these visions. And he's like, oh, okay, I know what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, 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 for sure. It was interesting that the visions weren't. It really felt like they were CGI plastic characters.
Mm.
When I think Eggers has always been more of a practical guy.
Yeah.
The scene where they raid the first village, it was pointed out to me, my friend, after that it was kind of shot in one take, and I didn't even realize it, but that was all practical.
Yeah.
But I was so both enthralled and disgusted by the violence to really notice.
Did you find any kind of like comedic bits in this? Like dark comedy.
Unintentionally, I think. I think unintentionally, yeah. Like any of the scenes with Willem Dafoe.
Well, that was kind of obvious comedy, but I think Eggers was aiming for a sort of dark comedy. He talked about it in an interview, and I think I picked up a few examples where like the first one that really jumped out for me was when they have that one take battle scene that you were just mentioning where the berserkers are going nuts over the Russian village. And then it kind of smash cuts to them and they're just like normal dudes again. And they're almost like having water cooler chat.
Yeah.
While they're still coated in blood. And they're just like, screwing around in the village after the fight's over. That comic timing to me felt intentional. And then the other one was just a title card. And it was just when after Amleth gets the special sword, card comes up and it says the Nightblade feeds. That to me felt like a little bit of a joke.
I totally didn't get the humor behind it. The title cards reminded me of the Green Knight. Mm. I thought the Green Knight's title cards had more of a comedic effect on me. I think from going into this, I knew it was partially based on mythology. I always took things that were absurd and sort of out of ordinary as normal. In the sense of the movie and within the context of the movie.
Right.
I mean, the only comedy I could find was when I think it was Fionor who tries to sleep with Olga, right?
Yeah.
And Olga rubs period blood on his face.
Yeah.
and then he's like disgusted by this woman, even though he's like killed so many different people and had blood smeared all over his face before.
Yeah.
I just thought that was kind of funny, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't think it would be disgusting enough to stop him.
Exactly. But I guess
there's a bit of like a maybe mythology or body science that they weren't aware of, so it was like a sign from the gods or something that maybe you shouldn't do anything to this woman. I don't know.
Yeah, there was definitely some old stigmas around that I remember reading about, so that's possible that's what they were trying to capture.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it's funny that Olga decided to use that because
yeah. Yeah, the love story I thought was definitely the weakest part. I liked everything else. Not a movie I'd ever watch again, though, actually.
Oh, really? I would definitely...
Just a little too brutal.
I would watch it again, maybe not right away, but I just like Eggers' visual style, you know? Like, if stripping away...
There were definitely some scenes that I absolutely loved and would watch again. So the fight where he earns the sword.
Yeah.
I love that part.
Yeah.
The Berserker raid, I mean, I would watch it again just for giggles. Even the scene where Ethan Hawke dies, I thought that was really well done. But
yep.
Sitting through a two-hour movie with like people getting maimed and stuff, I don't know.
Now, here's an important question. This is a good one to kind of transition to the next segment.
Okay.
Would you put this up there with other historical revenge flicks like, say, Gladiator or...
Mm-hmm.
Not so much Kingdom of Heaven. That doesn't have much of a revenge plot. Troy.
Right. Okay.
Things like that. Would you put it on that tier or is it not quite that good?
Troy has gotten better with age and you have to watch the extended version, I think, to get the full brunt of it. But all in all, I don't think it's that good of a movie. I think Northman is way better than Troy, but it's definitely not on Gladiator level.
Hmm, interesting.
I think Gladiator is one of the best revenge movies I've ever seen. It's a personal favorite. I don't think the Northman, maybe outside of some technical categories, would sweep like Gladiator did.
Mm.
I think Gladiator just had a more engaging story because it had the political subplots. It had more of a historical basis. Things are rooted a bit more in reality.
Interesting. Yeah, well, the Gladiator definitely doesn't do any of the fantasy elements. So
No. But like overthrowing Caesar and the Senate stuff and, you know, palace intrigue. You get a more simplified version of this in the Northmen because their court, so to speak, isn't as, you know, robust or sophisticated.
Yeah, because we're seeing like Rome at the peak of its power versus small communities in the Northmen.
I think Gladiator, Russell Crowe's performance was one of his all-time best.
Yeah.
So that's a real key selling point for me.
Mm. I would put it like top five like historical revenge stuff, okay. but not like it doesn't beat Gladiator. It's in the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's very good. I gave it 4 out of 5. So you gave it 4.5.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. So I personal preference, but the gore I thought was a bit much. But again, the acting and some of the plot elements, even the pacing, sometimes the part where he's sort of like planning out his revenge and kind of like sulking around the village and all that, I thought that went on for a little too long.
You gotta feel for the revenge. It's gotta take a while to simmer.
It felt like a bit of a Terrence Malick movie at one point, because I'm watching him like order people around and baling hay and cutting grass, and I'm like, dude, come on, it's a revenge story. Let's get going here.
Cut off a few more noses and rip out a few more guts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But good movie overall. Recommend it.
All right. Well, staying in the kind of, I guess, violent frame of mind would be...
Well, there's one scene, yeah, that is super violent.
Yeah, there's a couple, yeah. But so we're going to talk about Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, the new Marvel film.
You cannot control everything, Strange. You opened the doorway between universes, and we don't know who or what will walk through it.
Wanda, what do you know about the multiverse?
Viz had his theories. He believed it was dangerous.
He was right.
There was a lot of discussion online about what, just how violent this movie was, if it, if the PG-13 rating it got from the MPA was appropriate. There was then a subsequent conversation online of people saying, oh, well, you guys are all babies who grew up with, you know, you've all been coddled by the MCU. You don't know what real violence looks like, blah, 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 blah. So there was a lot of sniping about violence and stuff. Suffice to say, what you're going to see in the new Doctor Strange movie has some violent moments, but yeah, it's not true like PG-13 violence, I don't think.
No, it's got a bit of a horror element. And again, I don't know what dark corners of the internet you go to.
This is just my regular Twitter feed.
Okay, I did not get this at all. I mean, I'm on Twitter fairly often, but like I kind of tend to stay away from those corners and those topics, I guess. So that went over my head. But Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, directed by Sam Raimi, who is a B-movie / horror movie veteran, also a superhero movie veteran, director of Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 and 3. Spider-Man 2 being, I think, a favorite of ours.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So in this movie, following the events of... See, it's so messy. I can't recall right away.
I guess No Way Home.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. Following the events of No Way Home... this movie focuses on Doctor Strange, played by our wonderful Benedict Cucumber Patch, featuring Elizabeth Olsen back as Wanda Maximoff, the Scarlet Witch. And basically the plot is the multiverse has opened. There is it's all sorts of dark magic going on. There's a new character played by Xochitl Gomez, who is this new character called America Chavez, and she has the ability to jump through multiverses. And this whole multiverse idea is brought on by No Way Home, because we got Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. And so what's happening is that all these multiverses are colliding, and it's an impending catastrophe that only Doctor Strange and Scarlet Witch can resolve. And so... the movie basically is them hopping through different multiverses, establishing some of the laws of time travel and multiverse travel. And Wanda Maximoff, Scarlet Witch, she makes a big heel turn, and she's ultimately revealed as the villain in this film. And she kind of faces off with Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Hopefully I didn't spoil too much, but that's basically the gist of the story.
I mean, yeah, that's basically what you would get from the poster, I'd say, because there's no prominent villains on the poster. So you'd have to assume that Scarlet Witch is definitely heading more towards the villain side of the spectrum. And especially if you'd watched WandaVision, you would probably have anticipated a bit of that, because she definitely took on a more villainous side, especially as that show came to a close. The show kind of ended a little bit ambiguously. It didn't really say out and out, oh yeah, she's definitely a villain now, but it said she's playing around with some bad stuff, so it's possible.
I thought the title was really misleading, because in my opinion, I feel like she should have been the main character in this film.
Oh yeah,
it's kind of criminal not to have her in the title. It should be Doctor Strange and Scarlet Witch in the Multiverse of Madness.
I agree.
It's a long title, but who cares?
Or you could just be like, take a page from DC and go like Doctor Strange versus Scarlet Witch or something.
Yeah. No, it's not versus, it's V.
V, true. Yeah. No, but this, I came in, I was kind of meh on the whole thing. I was
like the film or before going to see it?
No, the film itself. Like I was, I liked certain parts of it. I didn't really have any strong reactions to any of it. Because
really interesting,
like as much as I like Sam Raimi as a director and I liked how you could pick up on some of his auteur flourishes here and there.
Yep, for sure.
It still very much felt to me like they have these characters in a sandbox and they're just kind of throwing them at each other at this point. It's like, all right, we got some Doctor Strange, we got some Scarlet Witch. Let's like ping them off each other and see what happens because they're both magic wielders. So, you know, and they are trying to like move the train towards this multiverse show off thing a little bit. You know, in terms of the broader Phase 4 story, I think they have a plan of how they want this to flow together. But, I mean, other than the novelty of seeing her depicted as a, like a, I guess, a horror villain or a horror monster, you know, the some of the scenes of, like, you know, they're running away from her through that tunnel with the alternate universe version of Rachel McAdams' character, and they're looking over their shoulder and they're terrified because they know that if she catches up with them, she's going to rip them to pieces. All of those things, like those were bits that I hadn't seen in an MCU movie before.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of, that felt kind of fresh,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't really, maybe it's because I don't really identify with the Doctor Strange character very much. I find him.
No, fair enough. Yeah. I find him kind of annoying.
He's better when he's like the cranky side character who is being pissed off by some other mm-hmm. more prominent character like Spider-Man or the Hulk mm-hmm. or whoever, you know.
I totally agree with you. I think Scarlet Witch is the biggest selling point of this movie. I think it's a bit of a meh film because you could tell that it is very formulaic in certain aspects. So you have Doctor Strange, the hero. You introduce a new hero with America Chavez, who is this doe-eyed kid with superhero powers that she can't control
yep.
until the very end, until she really needs to, until the plot yep. demands her to.
Exactly.
You have this really uninteresting love story between Benedict Cumberbatch and Rachel McAdams, who I do not care for at all. Not that I don't like Rachel McAdams, I just don't like her character because I feel like she's very unnecessary. I do like certain parts of it. I do like the different versions of Doctor Strange and all the characters. I think that's very interesting. It also opens the door a lot for a lot of other characters to get involved, and we'll get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the sort of the dynamic between her and Doctor Strange is very interesting.
Between America?
No, between Scarlet Witch and Doctor Strange.
Oh, okay.
I think that dynamic is quite interesting. There's a line that they talk about in the movie how she says, you break the rules and you're a hero and I break the rules and I'm the bad guy.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very interesting dynamic, although they didn't really go into it that much. And we're going to spoil.
I mean, it all has to do with that dark book of magic, the dark
yeah,
hold.
Yeah, you know, the book of the damned.
It changes hands over the course of the film, but I don't know. Sometimes it felt like the rules that they were talking about were kind of being made up as they went.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at one moment they're like, all right, here's this really evil book, but then it doesn't really matter if we destroy it because all of the stuff that's in it was actually transcribed from some evil fortress in the mountains that no one has talked about before.
Yeah. And there's a lot of CGI action that, if you think about it, just kind of looks kind of dumb when they're doing it.
Yeah.
So, for example, they save America Chavez. They carry her to the Camartage, which is, I guess, where all these sorcerers, you know, practice and train to be sorcerers and witches and whatever. There's a part where she comes flying in and she's like throwing these like red fireballs at them.
Yeah.
And then the answer to her fireballs is to load like these 19th century looking cannons one by one. And you're just like, dude, you know magic. Why are you loading cannons? Like it's a freaking pirate ship.
They can't magic up like a AK-47 or something.
Yeah. Or something like that. And it's just like, wow, for a, you know, highly secret bastion of sorcerers, you guys have terrible defenses.
Yeah.
And there, so there's a lot of stuff that like that doesn't make sense. I was talking to my friend about this. Is in superhero movies, the power dynamic and the strength of each hero is never properly defined.
Yeah.
So the good guys win when they need to, and the bad guys win when they need to.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. America Chavez, again, I like the introduction of her character because sometimes these new young superhero characters tend to be annoying. I didn't find her annoying at all.
No, she was all right.
I just thought the fact that she suddenly realized how to control her powers at the end of the movie to save everyone is just too convenient. And we've seen this in all these Marvel films as well. And like you said, you could see the parts where Sam Raimi has his clear fingerprints with the horror elements. Especially the part where the Scarlet Witch is chasing them through, like, reflections and stuff. That was really interesting.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was well done.
But then you get to, like, the overall arching plots. And I think Sam Raimi in an interview talked about this, too, how he had to shoot certain things because Marvel asked them to.
Yeah.
And it's very apparent that at certain points there are two different movies in this movie.
Yeah. Because, and getting to your point of, like, you know, you can't really understand the power balance between the various people. They don't really defeat Scarlet Witch through any natural weakness in her powers or through any kind of cleverness. It's just because they show her a vision of, like, how if she's successful with her plan, her two sons will hate her. So then she just decides to not do the thing she was going to do and seemingly commit suicide, although it's unclear exactly if she survives that rock fall, but whatever.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, because WandaVision, we get like a full 10-hour arc of how she becomes sort of engulfed in this grief and she ends up hurting the people, innocent people.
Yes.
And then in this one, she does the heel turn and then goes back to good again within a span of 2 hours.
Yeah.
It felt like WandaVision treated her heel turn a lot better than this movie. Although I have to say I really enjoyed Scarlet Witch as a villain. I wish she stayed as the villain the entire time. I wish she got defeated and got banished into some multiverse that, you know, so we can use her again when we need to. And I wish she didn't do the self-sacrifice thing and die a hero thing.
Yeah.
Because it didn't make as much sense to me.
And really, I mean, crafting the ending that way, they kind of make like Doctor Strange's input into the whole thing meaningless because he's defeated. Like he has that zombie version of himself that he's kind of reanimated and he's got like the wings made of ghosts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This all sounds completely like crazy when you say it out loud.
But just watch it and you'll get it. But that's the best part. Zombie Strange was the best. Anyway,
they like Scarlet Witch defeats him and like he's just like prone on the ground, and then that's when America's powers finally kick in and she's able to show Scarlet Witch the error of her ways.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, it's almost sort of like the ending to Wonder Woman 1984 in that it's more about like getting the villain to stop doing the thing that they want to do just based on like persuasion. Anyway.
I get it. Yeah. Same with like the falling off the cliff thing with Wong, where he falls off the cliff and you're like, haha, yeah, he's not dead, come on.
No,
I've seen
no.
this before.
Yeah.
So but there are legit interesting things. I think like you get glimpses of all the different multiverses. Like there's one that's like animated, there's one where they're made of paint, there's one with the pizza balls.
I just wish they spent a bit more time in each one. Like they have that quick transition, that montage where they kind of flash through all of them very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
For my money, Everything Everywhere All at Once did it slightly better because we spend a bit more time with each visual joke and we can understand like, okay, this really is an infinite set of universes. You know, there's... And some of the things are just really wacky, like somebody with hot dog fingers. Like I never felt like Doctor Strange 2 did anything really unexpected with the different multiverses in that way, you know?
There is one part in Doctor Strange that I absolutely loved, and you can probably guess what that is. And it's when they travel to this new multiverse called Earth 838.
Yes. Yep.
And in that universe, that universe is Doctor Strange. I know it sounds weird, but it makes sense if you watch it. Just trust me. That universe is Doctor Strange, has died.
Yep.
And Earth is protected by this group of superheroes who make up this council called the Illuminati.
Hilarious. Yeah.
And it consists of Karl Mordor, who is the villain in the first Doctor Strange movie. Was he like a side villain though? Because Caecilius was
The Mads Mikkelsen character primary villain. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Karl Mordor, it's got Peggy Carter, Black Bolt, a different Captain Marvel, Reed Richards, and Charles Xavier.
And that's like the biggest fan service moment because, you know, anyone who had watched the What If show on Disney Plus, they would recognize Captain Carter from that. I didn't watch that show, but I was familiar with the fact that she had appeared as that character in that show. Black Bolt, he had been seen, played by the same actor on an earlier Marvel show called Inhumans.
Yeah, you ever watch that show?
No, I heard it was awful.
It's not good.
So
yeah, it's not good. Anyway, I watched one episode. It was it. Anyway,
a nice little bonus for Anson Mount fans, I suppose. You know, they get to see him again in the character. Maybe the version in this movie is a little bit more accurate or comics accurate. I don't know. And then Lashana Lynch, who we had just seen as the new 007 in No Time to Die, she appears here as a black Captain Marvel. Who has all the powers of Brie Larson's version, but played by a different actress. And yeah, then the two like headline grabbers are probably John Krasinski as Reed Richards from the Fantastic Four. And of course, Patrick Stewart coming in his yellow colored robotic wheelchair, the one from the 90s cartoon. They even play a few bars of the intro music from that show.
I know, that was awesome. Actually, sorry, can we talk about the music? Danny Elfman, fantastic score, though.
I didn't recognize it as Danny Elfman until his credit came up at the end, and then I immediately heard it. I was like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
But it was good music. I thought the musical cues and everything, it was all very nicely done. But I loved this scene because Scarlet Witch goes full-on villain mode, and it was so exciting to see Marvel take this step into like a more violent, I wouldn't say realistic, but definitely a little bit more bloody and gory battle than we've ever seen before.
They get a hall pass, though, because, you know, they're doing it in a universe where it doesn't really matter. We may never see those characters again. So they get their cake and eat it, too. You know, they can kill off characters without sacrificing the ones that fans love.
So
anyway,
this is why I think John Krasinski will not be cast in the official Fantastic Four movie. And this is probably the last time we'll see Patrick Stewart as Charles Xavier. I think both those characters will be recast because I don't think we're going to focus on Earth 838 in the future versions. I think the Earth we're going to focus on is Earth 616, I think it is.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just enjoyed watching them maim all the superheroes because, you know, I kind of like to see the villain win sometimes. I liked seeing Captain Carter get cut in half by her own shield.
Yeah.
I liked watching Reed Richards turn into spaghetti with a little splat poof at the end. I thought that was really funny. I think it's funny that they keep killing off Charles Xavier.
Yep. He's died how many times now on camera? Like three at least?
I cannot count.
He was vaporized in The Last Stand, and he dies of
like... He dies twice, I think, in Days of Future Past.
He dies in Logan.
Yep. And he dies in this one.
Yeah.
So four times.
Mm.
How many times can you really kill him off? You know, like for the world's most powerful mutant, he does kind of get killed off quite quickly. Although Jean Grey is the most powerful mutant, isn't she?
I can't remember.
But then Scarlet Witch, they say, is the most powerful mutant or superhero in the Marvel universe. So again, crazy, weird power dynamic, power scales that don't really make sense.
Yeah, like if Scarlet Witch showed off, and because they've also said that Captain Marvel is supposed to be the new leader of the Avengers and she's the most powerful. So
I think Brie Larson said that herself. I don't even know.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever the case may be. Yeah. It doesn't seem like it was a very fair fight in this scene. So whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I loved it. Was this your favorite part of the movie though?
That's a good question.
Because I agree with you. There are really good highs, and this is one of them, and really low lows. The lows we just talked about, how it was very formulaic. But
yeah, that sequence is definitely up there. I don't know that it was my favorite.
Part of it is me liking the fan service in this one a bit more.
Yeah, which is interesting because you don't normally always go for this, the straight up fan service.
I think I like it because even though I just talked about how the Northman was too gory, I liked how they killed off everyone in this one.
Yeah, well, this is Marvel's version of gory. Like, this is probably the most violent we've seen them get. And obviously that was a bridge too far for certain people who were, you know, whining about it online. But yeah, I don't think you're going to see Marvel step up and do like a Deadpool style thing right away. They may do it. Who knows?
Maybe in the future. Yeah. Yeah. But you didn't have a favorite scene? That's interesting. You found it so underwhelming.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it comes back to the main character. Like, one of my favorite Doctor Strange moments is actually in Thor Ragnarok when he makes Loki fall infinitely through like a couple of portals. And like, it's just
and forgets about him.
Yeah, and just forgets about him. Like, that for me is like as much as I care about Doctor Strange, and it's more about like what the little things that he does that pisses other people off. And so to have an entire movie based around him, it's fine. It looks great, blah blah blah, but I'm not there rooting for the moments in the way that I think I'm supposed to.
Do we have time to go over the other two stuff really quick?
Yeah, let's try to cram it in.
Okay. So, Winning Time. This is a HBO show subtitled The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. And this is about Magic Johnson and the advent of the Showtime Lakers of the 80s, which had a very historic rivalry with the Boston Celtics and Larry Bird. This is a bit of a mockumentary / tongue-in-cheek film, like any of all the other
Adam McKay
projects. So John C. Reilly plays Jerry Buss. He is the owner of the Lakers. Quincy Isaiah plays Magic Johnson, his prized player. And Jason Clark plays Jerry West, who is this former Lakers legend who's still involved with the team. Adrian Brody's Pat Riley, the coach. Jason Siegel's Paul Westhead, another coach. And Tracy Letts is Jack McKinney, another coach. And it's this mishmash of like all these different personalities and characters coming in. A tale about how the NBA really struggled, and because of the Showtime Lakers, really launched everyone into superstardom.
I don't care who you are. If you're a human being with two eyes and a heart, this game, this industry, makes you feel good. One, two, three,
four. What industry? Sweat socks?
No, show business.
Very well done. For those who are like turned off by Adam McKay in that Don't Look Up movie, which is both of us, I think.
Yes.
It's good that he dials it back quite a bit. He's not the showrunner. It's created by Max Borenstein, who did Godzilla, and Jim Hecht. So, and it's based on a book. So you can't really veer too much away from it.
Okay.
Although, interesting enough, Jerry West, the real Jerry West, is planning on suing HBO and the whole production because he felt that they had defamed his character somehow. It is ridiculous on how they treat some of the characters because they do become caricatures.
Oh.
But I think that's part of like the comedy behind it. You're not supposed to take it that seriously. It is not a regurgitated fact for fact historic timeline of events, but if you're into Adam McKay humor, John C. Reilly's fantastic. I think it does tell a fairly interesting story if you're into basketball. If you're not into basketball, maybe not so much, but I'd say 7.5-8 out of 10, that range.
Okay,
not bad.
Well, two behind the scenes questions for you though. Was this the project that Bo Burnham was supposed to play Larry Bird in? Or is that a different project?
I can't recall, but you're probably right. This was the project where Will Ferrell was supposed to play Jerry Buss.
Yes.
And because he didn't, him and Adam McKay, like, they never publicly said it, I think, and you kind of have to read between the lines.
Well, Adam McKay said as much in an interview. He said that this, like, broke their friendship, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't know that he had come out publicly, said that. It was my friend who told me later that this actually happened, but I could see why.
Yeah.
But then again, Will Ferrell would have been Will Ferrell, not Jerry Buss. John C. Reilly is a better actor in terms of being a chameleon, being able to sink his teeth into something and disappear into a role.
Yes. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I agree with that appraisal of John C. Reilly, I feel like it would have been difficult for Will Ferrell, you know, as much of a basketball fan as he is, and I'm sure he knows the story cold. I don't see him in those kind of like historical fiction roles.
Yeah, fair enough.
Quite the same way as I do with John C. Reilly.
Second question.
Well, the Bo Burnham thing again, like the, I heard that he had been cast as Larry Bird, but had to pull out because his stand-up show schedule was kind of conflicting with it. If that's the case, I mean, I would have considered watching it for Burnham because I've just like, I'm on a roll with him lately. But if it means that we get a new Netflix special from Burnham instead of a Larry Bird performance, I'm okay with that trade.
Yeah. And Larry Bird is very much a secondary character. It showed, obviously, it focuses on the Lakers, but Larry Bird's appearances don't really come until the latter half of the season, which covers the first season of Magic Johnson's career with the Lakers. So are there going to be future seasons? I don't know. There could be. There are interesting storylines that they only hinted towards, including Magic Johnson's public announcement that he had contracted AIDS. That was kind of hinted in the first episode, but they never got to that part. So I don't know if this is a standalone or if there's multiple seasons going to be made, but not bad.
Okay. Well, then a similar quick review for Apollo 10 and a half, because this is another one that's kind of like, it's easy to get. It's on Netflix. And it's another sort of historical fiction, like lightly satirized type of story. So these two segments kind of work well together, actually. We didn't plan this. But
yeah, we did.
So this is a story from Richard Linklater, who people will know from School of Rock and Boyhood and Scanner Darkly and many films going back over the past two or three decades, I guess it's been. And favorite filmmaker of mine, but we've seen him experiment with rotoscoped animation before. First in, I think it was Waking Life, 2000, 2001, then again in Scanner Darkly with Keanu Reeves. And now again, where, you know, essentially he shoots the entire movie with real cameras and then has VFX houses, animation studios do a pass over top of it to kind of make it look like it was animated. And so you can very clearly see some of the actors who were cast in the live action footage. We've got Zachary Levi in here and Jack Black is on the voiceover track. So you get these kind of celebrities popping up, these friends of Linklater, but it's all presented more as an animated story. And it's telling the tale of the first moon landing in 1969. But the reason why it's called Apollo 10 and a half is because they've concocted this kind of little fable around, oh, what if before Apollo 11 successfully landed on the moon, they accidentally made the lunar lander a little bit too small? How would they test that? How would they do the safety checks on it without having to build a whole new lunar lander? Why don't they recruit a kid to fly a mission to the moon, do exactly what Apollo 11 did, and just keep it a secret from everybody? Because obviously people would have a problem with endangering a child like that.
Listen, are you good at math?
Yeah.
Do you get a perfect 100 on every test?
No.
Okay. We need a kid like you to test this accidentally smaller version on the lunar surface and soon.
Stan, you're our only hope.
Okay.
And so the central kid is just a regular Texas school kid who gets recruited because he's good at math and a good problem solver, but he has to keep this mission totally secret from all of his family and friends. And you think that going into it, you think the movie is going to be just a simple little adventure story, but I would say the first 45 minutes to an hour of this hour and a half movie is literally just Jack Black doing the adult voice of this kid reminiscing about his life in Texas. We don't get any of the moon landing adventure stuff until the final half an hour. And it's really kind of like a side story to this guy, voiced by Jack Black, reminiscing about what it was like to grow up in Texas in the late 60s. And it's just slice of life stuff. And it did get a little bit tiresome after a while, but I kind of liked it. Nevertheless, you know, I feel very kind of mixed about it because I went into it hoping for the moon adventure stuff and I got the slice of life Texas story, but it's so well presented and well acted Linklater has always been really good at finding actors, whether they're professional or non-professional, and giving them good material and just kind of seeing where they go with it. And that's really what we have here.
I think that's a common refrain with Richard Linklater, is that sometimes you just get really frustrated by him because he just takes so long. And I get he's trying to let things breathe and find their own natural path. But it's kind of like, dude, I'm on limited time here. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, if this was any longer than 90 minutes, I would have been annoyed. But luckily, it is really trim. And but you're totally right. Like, there's a kind of like slacker, which is kind of a pun because it's one of his first movies was Slacker. But it's this kind of stoner, lackadaisical type of thing that is good in small doses. Like, you wouldn't want to be watching like a Richard Linklater movie marathon, because you might come out the other side of it and just like want to sleep for a while.
Yeah, or just want to smack him around a little bit, you know. Jack Black, though, does he play it pretty straight, or is it like the typical Tenacious D Jack Black type?
Oh no, he plays it pretty straight. Yeah, he's okay. I think he understands that like the character he's playing is just supposed to be a regular dude, mm-hmm. from Texas, and so he's literally just reading off the things that happened to this kid when he was growing up in the late 60s, and mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so if you like Richard Linklater, if you like this kind of style of rotoscoped animation, mm-hmm. from his previous films, it's an easy watch on Netflix. Check it out if it's your thing, but don't expect too much moon stuff, because that's not the focus, even no matter what the marketing tells you.
Yeah, the title is quite misleading.
But yeah, that about does it for this episode. But we have a pretty exciting one coming up for our next episode. We will actually be in person together for like,
oh my God.
I don't know, this is like the third or fourth episode we've ever done in person.
Yeah.
So I will be in Vancouver. I'll be joining Jason. We're not sure what movie we'll be covering yet, but we'll go to see something in the Vancouver area and then come back and talk about it,
mm-hmm.
Along with anything else we happen to have seen, mm-hmm. In between. So get excited for that, because those episodes are always a lot of fun to produce. And then looking ahead, of course, we will have some coverage of Top Gun Maverick on the immediate horizon. Maybe a little bit of Jurassic World Dominion, like we were mentioning from the cold open. So those are probably coming up in the maybe two episodes from now.
There's definitely a bit of a different dynamic when you do things in person. And we'll have to decide what to watch. That'll be interesting. But I think that does it for this episode. My name is Jason Chen in Vancouver.
And my name's Robert Snow in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.